China 21 is produced by the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. We are a university-based think tank that produces original research to anchor major policy discussions on China and its relationship to the United States. This podcast features expert voices, insights, and stories about Chinese economy, politics, society, and the implications for international affairs. Learn more at china.ucsd.edu. Welcome to China 21, the official podcast for the 21st Century China Center. I'm your host, Samuel Choi. Exactly 3 weeks from today, voters in the U.S. will go to the polls to select the next president. And American citizens will not be the only ones who are affected by the results. Chinese citizens are also following closely because the two great powers will be more intertwined in the next 4 to 8 years, especially in the economic realm. And diplomats from each side will undoubtedly face more challenges as well as new opportunities to cooperate. The bilateral relationship between the United States and the People's Republic of China is perhaps the most consequential one, and it will only intensify for the next administration. Here with us today is an expert who can illuminate some of the challenges as well as opportunities. Dr. Melanie Hart has worked on various facets of the U.S.-China relationship. She has spent a significant part of her career here at UC San Diego, where she received her PhD in political science. Welcome back, Melanie.
Great to be here.
And thanks so much for being our speaker for tonight's China Town Hall event. The China Town Hall is a nationwide conversation happening in over 80 venues across 40 states today, hosted by the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, where Melanie is a member. She's also a member of the Advancement Committee for the School of Global Policy and Strategy here at UC San Diego, and serves on the board of the American Mandarin Society. And those are only her volunteer positions. Melanie is currently a senior fellow and director of China Policy at the Center for American Progress, a think tank based in Washington, D.C. She focuses on U.S. foreign policy toward China and works to identify new opportunities for bilateral cooperation, particularly on energy, climate change, and cross-border investment. Her research also covers China's political system, market regulatory reforms, and how China's domestic and foreign policy developments affect the United States. Before joining the Center for American Progress, she worked at the Aspen Institute, Qualcomm, and as a China advisor for the Scowcroft Group and the University of California Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. So to start, let's take a step back and look at the last 8 years. So as the Obama presidency concludes, how has American foreign policy towards China evolved in the last 8 years?
Well, if we look back to 2009, President Obama took office the same year that we knew over 200 nations, around 200 nations, would be gathering for the big Copenhagen Climate Summit in December 2009, which was a great opportunity to finally try to get progress on a new global climate deal that would finally, for the first time, include the United States and China, which continue to be the world's biggest emitters. And so my personal impression is that energy and climate issues were high on the agenda for the Obama administration from the very beginning. President Obama took office at a time when clean energy technologies were finally becoming available at large scale and turning energy from a zero-sum issue into an expandable cooperation issue for the United States and China. So 2009 was the big opportunity to reach out to Beijing, build on some of the good progress that was made during the Bush administration under Hank Paulson's leadership, and really bring forward a new kind of U.S.-China partnership that could ideally lead the rest of the world toward a global climate deal at Copenhagen. President Obama visited China for the first time in November 2009, and they did make some progress on the energy front, but the December 2009 Copenhagen summit, most who were there would describe the U.S.-China interactions as an epic clash. And so I think leaders on both sides went home in December somewhat shocked at how difficult things had been, and quite determined to fix that issue and really turn this around and make it a great area of cooperation. And that effort has been the core centerpiece of U.S.-China relations under the Obama administration from 2009, 2010 through 2014, when they finally succeeded in jointly announcing a game-changing parallel targets for a new global treaty that succeeded in rallying the world around for action. So that's been the continuous story throughout the Obama administration. Over the past few years, there have been some new storylines emerging as some negative, more problematic issues have begun to climb up the agenda in U.S.-China relations. And so they've had to focus much more of their political attention and resources on the more difficult issues in U.S.-China relations. But we do have to remember that they did achieve some really big successes, and that gives us some good firm ground going forward.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for that summary, and we'll go into a little bit more detail about your perspective in the front lines and seeing how the U.S. and China essentially turned a point of contention and competitiveness into an opportunity for cooperation. So thank you so much for that summary. So based on that, how do you see the prospects for the next administration, given the election season and also the domestic challenges for in both countries?
In an ideal situation, we would only be focused on building on these great successes. We've had big wins with China under President Obama's leadership. We have a new global climate deal under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Over the weekend, we also got a new global climate deal on hydrofluorocarbons under the Montreal Protocol that would not have been possible without Chinese support and leadership. The United States has worked with China on Iranian nonproliferation. We would not have had an Iran deal without China's support and leadership. So we've had these great successes. However, at the same time, China has also been demonstrating an increasing willingness to use its new strengths in ways that do not support the U.S. vision for the global community, that clash with a lot of other nations' interests and vision for a peaceful global community. One big example is the South China Sea. There have been some Chinese actions in that region that are increasing fears and unease among many nations around the region. There are growing concerns about how China uses its overseas development aid to reward friends and punish nations that do not support Chinese objectives. And there are very serious rising commercial concerns among U.S. businesses. The China market has always been an area of great opportunity for the United States. China's opening was something that many U.S. businesses participated in. So China's success was a success for the United States as well. And many Americans benefited from seeing China succeed and wanted to support and help that to the best of their ability. But in recent years, the Chinese government has begun to close that door. There's a new sentiment in China that American businesses are no longer needed, that they may get a hold of whatever American know-how they need, they may get a hold of through means that are not commercially fair, and walk a road forward that increasingly pushes U.S. businesses out and therefore starts to break this link of common interest in seeing China's economic success proceed. And so those issues have been increasing. The Obama administration has had some success at pushing back on problematic areas, but there is a long list of needs of not rebalancing the relationship, but perhaps recalibrating the U.S.-China relationship to make sure that the United States is taking the measures needed to protect American businesses, American interests, American national security on areas where our vision and China's vision just do not fit together well.
Mm-hmm. You recently published a report last month called Charting a New Course for U.S.-China Relationship. And it was based on findings from the U.S.-China Rising Scholars. U.S.-China Rising Scholars Strategic Dialogue, and it was a 3-day meeting hosted by the Center for American Progress. Can you describe how this particular dialogue came about, and what is the purpose and goal of this particular channel of dialogue?
Absolutely. I'm very lucky to work at the Center for American Progress, which is a think tank that takes its rising experts and gives them platforms to be out in the world doing great things. One thing I've noticed through CAP is that sometimes when we are able to engage in high-level meetings with Chinese counterparts, I'm often looking at the people who are about my age sitting in the back row on the other side of the conference room, and they don't speak up much during meetings. If the bosses are there, the staffers don't talk much. But you know that they wrote a lot of those talking points and that they have their own ideas that they're not contributing whenever the conversation's occurring at a very high level. So we started a new program that basically convenes the same type of strategic dialogue that you see happening at senior levels, but this time the bosses don't come. Instead, it's the rising generation of experts on both sides who are at the mid-career level. So that means we often have a role in shaping some of the thinking on both sides, but we aren't out in front. We aren't often the decision makers at the end of the day, and some of our ideas aren't necessarily heard. They don't necessarily make it into the final position that your side takes. And so we wanted to put those two sides together so that we could hear everything that the rising Chinese generation has to say, give the rising U.S. generation an opportunity to share their views, and aim to have the kind of very focused, sometimes a little bit combative, very frank dialogue to try to see if we can break past some of the sensitive issues that it's harder for our bosses to discuss.
Yeah, interesting. As you noted, the mid-career experts can really debate sensitive issues with the frankness that is harder for either previous generation or more senior level leadership. So what characteristics can you share with us from each side, the U.S. side, rising scholars and experts, and also the Chinese side, rising experts, and how they're different from the previous generation?
The most important characteristic is that everyone who participates in this dialogue is bilingual. And so the Chinese side is free to switch into Mandarin at any point with the confidence that everyone on the American side will perfectly understand them. And the Americans can use English or Mandarin. It's free choice. So the conversation flips back and forth, English sometimes, Mandarin sometimes. So no one is doing a language test. Everyone is just conveying their thoughts in whatever language enables them to do that in a very sharp manner. I speak Chinese. I sometimes do meetings in Mandarin. I often do meetings in Mandarin. But I have found that when I'm speaking a language that isn't my native language, I'm more cautious because it's harder to feel where you are. If you're pushing past what you normally say and you really want to be very honest, if you're speaking a foreign language, it can sometimes be hard to calibrate how far you're stepping over the line, and are you striking the balance that you want to strike in broaching something new? And so when everyone can speak their own native language and everyone can understand, then that's a very unique conversation dynamic, because most people, their listening comprehension is much stronger than their speaking ability. And I find that my Chinese counterparts, most of them, when they switch into Mandarin, suddenly things get a lot more interesting because they're not doing a language test anymore. They can roll forward and speak more naturally. So that's the biggest benefit that this format provides. Another benefit is that none of the participants have served a high government position before. And so that means nobody has a stake in any decisions that have been made by either side. And so both sides are generally very free to critique decisions that have been made by their own leadership, by the other side. I think that helps contribute to the free-flowing dialogue. Also, another ramification of the fact that no one's held a very senior government post is that people feel that it's okay for them to say something that might dramatically deviate from what U.S. leaders are saying or senior scholars are saying at the time. So lower stakes create a feeling that it's fine to perhaps start an argument with the other side and challenge some accepted notions. But everyone who participates in this is all there for the same goal, which is to really try to understand some of the differences in views. Our goal is to focus on differences more so than anything else. And the people that have joined us in this process have been spectacular at just really wanting to engage one another, build friendships within the group, mm-hmm. and try to get at the issues that we really struggle to get at often in many of the conferences mm-hmm. we attend in the United States and China.
Yeah, so it sounds like the process itself, beyond the substantive dialogue and the policy debates, is really important in building that culture, building that institution, so that there are people from both sides that can really come together and have those frank conversations. And as you described at the outset, in the start of the Obama presidency, there were these big global meetings like Copenhagen, and later on where we see the Paris Agreement. But in between, there are also these dialogues. Most prominently is the strategic and economic dialogue that was established in the beginning, where Secretaries Hillary Clinton and Timothy Geithner essentially co-managed China policy. So how does the Rising Scholar dialogue and other similar forms provide an opportunity as time progresses, as these dialogues continue to happen, to advance the collaboration? And you also traced a lot of the challenges you mentioned, namely the maritime disputes, cybersecurity, the ways that American businesses today feel that because of the political tightening and the kind of rising nationalism within China, and the kind of ideological control that Xi Jinping's administration is implementing. How are these issues going to be able to be discussed in these kind of forums? Are there subsequent or follow-up conversations in this particular Rising Scholar dialogue on these particular issues?
Absolutely. I think the best thing that a more casual Rising Scholar forum can contribute is better understanding about the different world views on both sides. If you look at the South China Sea issue and maritime security issues more broadly, both the United States and China recognize that we have a major risk of conflict in the South China Sea. Both sides have different ideas about a way forward, and they talk about those different ideas in track one government level settings. But what I find most interesting is that the two sides approach that issue with a completely different understanding of the facts about what led to the problem. From the US perspective, most American scholars that I know will tell you that we have a problem in the South China Sea because around 2008 and 2009, China changed its approach. It began to utilize its military, utilize Coast Guard ships, utilize fleets of fishing boats to much more aggressively assert long-standing maritime and territorial claims in the region, and China's show of force on those claims triggered reactions from other nations to defend their own claims and triggered a spiral of escalating tension. Most of the Chinese colleagues that I know will say that's completely wrong. What happened was when President Obama came into office and launched the U.S. rebalance to the Asia Pacific, the U.S. became a black hand pushing the Philippines, Vietnam, and other nations around the region that have claims in competition with China's to start arming up and becoming more assertive, and China had to step up to defend itself against that new U.S. position. And so I find it to be absolutely critical. The fact that we have such deep disagreement over the background of this crisis makes it very difficult to find out the ideal path forward. Because if you disagree over what the cause was, it's very difficult to agree over the solution. And I found that this type of Rising Scholar dialogue, where people have the ability to communicate in a nuanced way, bilingually, the kind of ease and relaxation such that they might put something on the table that they wouldn't say if there was too much scrutiny to their comments. It enables us to clarify exactly what are our different views here. And once you do that, you can start to identify, well, is there anything we can build upon that we do have in common? And what are the areas that are going to be particularly difficult? And, you know, just to underscore the difficulty of really understanding one another, in June, we spent 4 days together in Honolulu, our U.S. and China group. We had some wonderful engagements with U.S. military experts, with ocean experts. We spent hours upon hours discussing these issues. At the end of the conference, everybody contributed their key points, their key takeaways. We compiled those into one document. We discussed the document for hours. We revised it as a group. And then when I returned to Washington and wrote that up as the final conference report, a lot of the Chinese colleagues looked at it and said, you have a couple of these points completely wrong. You know, so that's not exactly what I was trying to say. Actually, what I was trying to say is this, or you phrased the difference between U.S. and China's side in our discussion like this, but actually, we all think it should be this way. So I found that actually, in terms of process, having a meeting, everyone contributing to your biggest takeaways, and then writing them down and having everyone edit those takeaways is really helpful for just trying to push forward the understanding of exactly what the other side is thinking and where they're coming from. My personal opinion is that's the best thing that scholars can be doing on both sides, and then sharing that with the people that are actually doing the official track negotiation so they can hopefully have some new understanding and new ideas to broaden the scope of the possible mm-hmm. for what we might be able to do together.
Yeah, it's interesting that you chose Honolulu, literally in the middle of the Pacific, where you're really able to identify specifically ocean policy being the next kind of diplomatic frontier for cooperation. Is there any plans for future discussions where you're selecting people who are experts in either technical or policy areas that can come together to work on kind of issue-specific collaboration?
So we've held one rising scholar discussion in Beijing and two in the United States now. And one issue that comes up more and more prominently every time we gather is the issue of U.S. alliances in the Asia Pacific and how those alliance relationships impact China and what the intentions are behind those relationships. Many of our Chinese counterparts voice deep unease with the U.S.-Japan alliance in particular. They view U.S. alliance relationships as being fundamentally designed to contain China and keep China down. And when I've been able to have some wonderful conversations with U.S. military leaders who are directly involved in those alliance relationships, and I can perceive a clear difference between what China is perceiving from those relationships and what the U.S. government and the Japanese government intend for China to perceive. Sometimes an issue might flare up, such as Chinese incursions on the East China Sea, and on specific issues, the U.S. and Japan have jointly sent a firm message to China that certain behavior is going to be a problem. But in terms of the relationship in general, it is not a relationship designed to keep China down. It's a relationship designed to support the overall peace and stability of the Asia Pacific, and that's a goal that we share with China. So I have particular interest, and many of the Rising Scholar Group participants have particular interest, in looking at ways that we can drill down a bit deeper on that particular issue and try to have a better understanding about what are those alliance relationships designed to achieve, how are they performing, what are China's views, and what might be some opportunities for bringing China into the circle a bit more on Northeast Asia security institutions. So we may consider in a next round bringing a U.S.-China team together and going to Seoul and Tokyo and talking to those alliance partners and trying to put a bit of a trilateral dimension on the conversation and improve our groups and our generation's understanding about the different views that come into play, not only U.S.-China, but also views from around the region, and see if we can make some solid recommendations on that particular issue in U.S.-China relations.
Yeah, fascinating to watch and just really important for the political dialogue and really contrast with the presidential elections. As we know, it's been a very unusual election season, to say the least. But one of the few predictable components at every election in recent history is how candidates mention China, often in very antagonistic ways. So what is one thing that you would like the average American voter to consider as they cast their ballot, as they consider how American foreign policy and power is projected? What's one thing about China that you wish an average American voter should know about?
Well, I think this is a very unique election season. And in a normal presidential election, we'd probably be debating China policy a lot more. This has been a very unique one, and the topics have been somewhat different than they would be in other cycles. In China, on China policy specifically, the most important thing for the average American to keep in mind is that China is often used as a stand-in for globalization writ large. It's not the case that all of our economic losses that have emerged as a byproduct of globalization are all China's fault. You know, China definitely engages in some policy regulatory practices that are a problem, that cost American jobs, that put American businesses out of business. And any administration needs to have a laser focus on those. But those are very specific issues. Having a vibrant trade and investment relationship with China is not in and of itself a bad thing for the U.S. economy. What we've seen over the past few decades is that as globalization unfolded, as the U.S. market became more integrated with the global market, we lost manufacturing jobs, we lost factory jobs, the kind of jobs that my grandfather had and supported a family of five on, just don't exist anymore in this country, or they only exist in very small numbers. And unfortunately, the U.S. really dropped the ball on supporting the people who lost out as part of that trend. So we did not get our globalization response policy right. We need to be doing much more work on job training, on education, on making college affordable so that someone who doesn't have deep pocket family support can still pursue the best education that they would like to pursue and get a job that pays well in the new globalized economy. We really stumbled on the domestic side of that, on taking care of American workers. And a lot of American politicians, they don't really want to talk about that issue because that's a hard issue. It's really hard and complicated and nuanced to talk about how do you build an American workforce that survives and thrives and comes out on top in a globalized economy. That's a nuanced argument that politicians, they think it just doesn't win voters. Instead, they like to say China threat, you know, China, just bash China over the head and blame China for everything, you know, talk about massive tariffs and labeling China a currency manipulator instead of talking about the real work that needs to be done in terms of income inequality and supporting the American middle class, supporting families, supporting working parents, giving American workers the critical pieces of the picture that they need to survive and thrive. And so I would just love to see this country start to really think about what do they need? What are the top five things that as individuals, as their family, what do they need? And then look with a very open mind which politicians at every level are offering to provide that and hold them accountable. If American citizens use their votes to decide who takes higher office, then we'll start to see some of those things being offered. But we'll have to, as part of that, we'll have to reject some of the simplistic everything is China's fault arguments and focus in on what specifically is missing here at home and how do we fix that.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much for illuminating some of these issues, and especially the issues that voters need to consider. And we just want to say thank you and really appreciate and look forward to learning more from you and wish you big success in the upcoming months and years as our country transitions and as the administration transitions. So thank you so much, Melanie.
Thank you.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you for listening to China 21, the podcast of the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. Visit china.ucsd.edu and connect with us on social media. 谢谢大家.